There is a long silence. Shafto finally rouses himself to say,
Sir, yes, sir.
So get prying.
Sir, yes, sir.
And make it look hasty. Hasty, come on, shake a leg.
Sir, yes, sir.
Shafto tries to get into the spirit of the thing. What's he going to use to pry a crate open? No crowbars in sight. He exits the cargo hold and strides down a passageway. Munkberg, following him closely, hovering, urging him to be hastier.
You're in a hurry. The Nazis are coming. You have to arm yourself. Think of your wife and kids back in Glasgow or Lubbock or wherever the fuck you're from.
Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, sir,
Shafto says indignantly.
No, no, not in real life, in your pretend role as this stranded merchant son of a bitch. Look, Shafto, look! Salvation is at hand!
Shafto turns around to see Munkberg pointing at a cabinet marked fire. Shafto pulls the door open to find, among other implements, one of those giant axes that firemen are always carrying in and out of burning structures. 30 seconds later, he's down in the cargo hold, Paul bunioning a crate of 45 caliber ammunition.
Faster! More haphazard!
Munkberg shouts.
This isn't a precise operation, Shafto. You're in a blind panic!
Then he says,
God damn it!
And runs forward and seizes the axe from Shafto's hands. Munkberg swings wildly, missing the crate entirely as he adjusts to the tremendous weight and length of the implement. Shafto hits the deck and rolls to safety. Munkberg finally gets his range and azimuth worked out and actually makes contact with the crate. Splinters and chips skitter across the deck.
See?
Munkberg says, looking over his shoulder at Shafto.
I want splinteriness. I want chaos.
He is swinging the axe at the same time as he's talking and looking at Shafto, and he's moving his feet too because the ship is rocking, and consequently, the blade of the weapon misses the crate entirely, overshoots, and comes down right on Munkberg's ankle.
Gadzooks,
Lieutenant Munkberg says, in a quiet conversational tone. He is looking down at his ankle in fascination. Shafto comes over to see what's so interesting. A good chunk of Munkberg's lower left leg has been neatly cross-sectioned. In the beam of Shafto's flashlight, it is possible to see severed blood vessels and ligaments sticking out of opposite sides of the meaty wound, like sabotaged bridges and pipelines dangling from the sides of a gorge.
Sir, you are wounded, sir,
Shafto says.
Let me summon Lieutenant Root.
No, you stay here and work,
Munkberg says.
I can find Root myself.
He reaches down with both hands and squeezes his leg above the wound, causing blood to gush out onto the deck.
Oh, this is perfect, he says meditatively. This adds so much realism.
After several repetitions of this order, Shafto reluctantly goes back to crate hacking. Munkberg hobbles and staggers around the hold for a few minutes, bleeding on everything, then drags himself off in search of Enoch Root. The last thing he says is,
Remember, we are aiming for a ransacked effect.
But the bit with the leg wound gets the idea across to Shafto more than Munkberg's words ever could. The sight of the blood brings up memories of Guadalcanal and more recent adventures. His last dose of morphine is wearing off, which makes him sharper, and he's starting to get really seasick, which makes him want to fight it by doing some hard work. So he more or less goes berserk with that axe. He loses track of what is going on. He wishes that Detachment 2702 could have stayed on dry land, preferably dry, warm land such as that place they stayed for 2 sunny weeks in Italy. The first part of that mission had been hard work, what with humping those barrels of shit around, but the remainder of it, except for the last few hours, had been just like shore leave, except that there weren't any women. Every day they'd taken turns at the observation site, looking out over the Bay of Naples with their telescopes and binoculars. Every night, Corporal Benjamin sat down and radioed more gibberish and Morse code. One night, Benjamin received a message and spent some time deciphering it. He announced the news to Shafto.
The Germans know we're here.
What do you mean, they know we're here?
They know that for at least 6 months we have had an observation post overlooking the Bay of Naples, Benjamin said.
We've been here less than 2 weeks.
They're going to begin searching this area tomorrow.
Well, then let's get the fuck out of here,
Shafto said.
Colonel Chatton orders you to wait, Benjamin said, until you know that the Germans know that we are here.
But I do know that the Germans know that we are here, Shafto said. You just told me.
No, Benjamin said. Wait until you would know that the Germans knew, even if you didn't know from being told by Colonel Chatton over the radio.
Are you fucking with me?
Orders, Benjamin said, and handed Shafto the deciphered message as proof. As soon as the sun came up, they could hear the observation planes crisscrossing the sky. Shafto was ready to execute their escape plan, and he made sure that the men were too. He sent some of those SAS blokes down to reconnoiter the choke points along their exit route. Shafto himself just laid down on his back and stared up at the sky, watching those planes. Did he know that the Germans knew now? Ever since he'd woken up, a couple of SAS blokes had been following him around, staring at him. Shafto finally looked in their direction and nodded. They ran away. A moment later, he heard wrenches crashing against the insides of toolboxes. The Germans had observation planes all over the fucking sky. That was pretty strong circumstantial evidence that the Germans knew, and those planes were clearly visible to Shafto, so he could, arguably, know that they knew. But Colonel Chatton had ordered him to stay put until positively sighted by Germans, whatever that meant. One of those planes, in particular, was coming closer and closer. It was searching very close to the ground, cutting only a narrow swath on each pass. Waiting for it to pass over their position, Shafto wanted to scream. This was too stupid to be real. He wanted to send up a flare and get this over with. Finally, in mid-afternoon, Shafto, lying on his back in the shade of a tree, looked straight up into the air and counted the rivets on the belly of that German aeroplane, a Henschel HS-126. Shafto had had nothing to do for the last couple of weeks except play hearts using know-your-enemy cards, so he could now peg model numbers of obscure Kraut observation planes. With a single swept-back wing mounted above the fuselage, so as not to block the view downwards, and with ladders and struts and giant awkward splay-footed landing gear sticking out all over. One German encased in a glass shroud and flying the plane, another out in the open, peering down through goggles and fiddling with a swivel-mounted machine gun. This one did all but look Shafto in the eye, then tapped the pilot on the shoulder and pointed down. The Henschel altered its normal search pattern, cutting the pass short to swing round and fly over their position again.
That's it,
Shafto said to himself. He stood up and began walking towards the dilapidated barn.
That's it,
he shouted.
Execute!
The SAS guys were in the back of the truck, under a tarp, working with their wrenches. Shafto glanced in their direction and saw gleaming parts from the Vickers laid out on clean white fabric. Where the hell had these guys gotten clean white fabric? They'd probably been saving it for today. Why couldn't they have got the Vickers in good working order before? Because they'd had orders to assemble it hastily at the last possible minute. Corporal Benjamin hesitated, one hand poised above his radio key. Sarge, are you sure they know we're here? Everyone turned to see how Shafto would respond to this mild challenge. He had been slowly gathering a reputation as a man who needed watching. Shafto turned on his heel and strolled out into the middle of a clearing a few yards away. Behind him, he could hear the other men of Detachment 2702 jockeying for position in the doorway, trying to get a clear view of him. The Henschel was coming back for another pass, now so close to the ground that you could probably throw a rock through its windshield. Shafto unslung his Tommy gun, pulled back the bolt, cradled it, swung it up and around, and opened fire. Now, some might complain that the trench broom lacked penetrating power, but he was positive he could see pieces of crap flying out of the Henschel's motor. The Henschel went out of control almost immediately. It banked until its wings were vertical, veered, banked some more until it was upside down, shed what little altitude it had to begin with, and made an upside-down pancake landing in the olive trees no more than 100 yards distant. It did not immediately burst into flame. Something of a letdown there. There was perfect silence from the other men. The only sound was the beepity-beep of Corporal Benjamin, his question now answered, sending out his little message.
Shafto was able to follow the Morse code for once. This message was going out plain text. We are discovered. Stop. Executing Plan Taurus. As their first contribution to Plan Taurus, the other men climbed onto the truck, which pulled out from its hidey hole in the barn and idled in the trees nearby. When Benjamin was finished, he abandoned his radio and joined them. As his first task of Plan Taurus, Shafto walked around the premises in a neat crisscross pattern, echoing that of the searching reconnaissance planes. He was carrying an upside-down gasoline can with no lid on it. He left the can about one-third full, standing upright in the middle of the barn. He pulled the pin from a grenade, dropped it into the gasoline, and ran out of the building. The truck was already pulling away when he caught up with it and dove into the waiting arms of his unit, who pulled them on board. He got himself situated in the back of the truck just in time to see the building go up in a satisfying fireball.
Okay, Shafto said to the men. We got a few hours to kill.
All the men in the truck, except for the SAS blokes working on the Vickers, looked at each other like, did he really just say that?
Oh, Sarge, one of them finally said, could you explain that part about killing some time?
The airplane's not going to be here for a while. Orders.
Was there a problem or...
Nope. Everything's going fine. Orders.
Beyond that, the men didn't want to gripe, but a lot more looks were exchanged across the bed of the truck. Finally, Enoch Root spoke up.
You men are probably wondering why we couldn't kill time for a few hours first, before alerting the Germans to our presence and rendezvous with the plane just in the nick of time.
Yeah, said a whole bunch of guys and blokes, vigorously nodding.
That's a good question, said Enoch Root.
He said it like he already knew the answer, which made everyone in the truck want to slug him. The Germans had deployed some ground units to secure the area's road intersections. When Detachment 2702 arrived at the first crossroads, all of the Germans were freshly dead, and all they had to do was to slow down momentarily so that some Marine raiders could run out of hiding and jump on board. The Germans at the second intersection had no idea what was going on. This was obviously the result of some kind of internal Wehrmacht communications fuck-up, clearly recognizable as such even across cultural and linguistic boundaries. Detachment 2702 were able to simply open fire from underneath the tarp and tear them to pieces, or at least drive them into hiding. The next Germans they ran into weren't having any of it. They had formed a roadblock out of a truck and two cars and were lined up on the other side of it, pointing weapons at them. All of their weapons looked to be small arms. But by this time, the Vickers had finally been put together, calibrated, fine-tuned, inspected, and loaded. The tarp came off. Private Mikulski, a surly, brooding 250-pound Polish-British SAS man, commenced operations with the Vickers at about the same time the Germans did with their rifles. Now, when Bobby Shafto had gone through high school, he'd been slotted into a vocational track and ended up taking a lot of shop classes. A certain amount of his time was, therefore, naturally, devoted to sawing large pieces of wood or metal into smaller pieces. Numerous saws were available in the shop for that purpose, some better than others. A sawing job that would be just ridiculously hard and lengthy using a handsaw would be accomplished with a power saw. Likewise, certain cuts and materials would cause the smaller power saws to overheat or seize up altogether, and therefore called for larger power saws. But even with the biggest power saw in the shop, Bobby Shafto always got the sense that he was imposing some kind of stress on the machine. It would slow down when the blade contacted the material. It would vibrate. It would heat up. And if you pushed the material through too fast, it would threaten to jam. But then one summer he worked in a mill where they had a bandsaw. The bandsaw, its supply of blades, its spare parts, maintenance supplies, special tools, and manuals, occupied a whole room. It was the only tool he had ever seen with infrastructure. It was the size of a car. The two wheels that drove the blade were giant 8-spoked things that looked to have been salvaged from steam locomotives. Its blades had to be manufactured from long rolls of blade stuff by unreeling about half a mile of toothed ribbon, cutting it off and carefully welding the cut ends together into a loop. When you hit the power switch, nothing would happen for a little while, except that a subsonic vibration would slowly rise up out of the earth, as if a freight train were approaching from far away, and finally the blade would begin to move, building speed slowly but inexorably until the teeth disappeared and it became a bolt of pure, hellish energy, stretched taut between the table and the machinery above it. Anecdotes about accidents involving the bandsaw were told in hushed voices, and not usually commingled with other industrial accident anecdotes. Anyway, the most noteworthy thing about the bandsaw was that you could cut anything with it, and not only did it do the job quickly and coolly, but it didn't seem to notice that it was doing anything. It wasn't even aware that a human being was sliding a great big chunk of stuff through it. It never slowed down, never heated up. In Shafto's post-high school experience, he had found that guns had much in common with saws. Guns could fire bullets all right, but they kicked back and heated up, got dirty and jammed eventually. They could fire bullets, in other words, but it was a big deal for them. It placed a certain amount of stress on them, and they could not take that stress forever. But the Vickers in the back of this truck was to other guns as the bandsaw was to other saws. The Vickers was water-cooled. It actually had a fucking radiator on it. It had infrastructure, just like the bandsaw, and a whole crew of technicians to fuss over it. But once the damn thing was up and running, it could fire continuously for days as long as people kept scurrying up to it with more belts of ammunition. After Private Mikulski opened fire with the Vickers, some of the other Detachment 2702 men, eager to pitch in and do their bit, took pod shots at those Germans with their rifles, but doing so made them feel so small and pathetic that they soon gave up and just took cover in the ditch and lit up cigarettes and watched the slow progress of the Vickers bullet stream across the roadblock. Mikulski hosed down all of the German vehicles for a while, yawing the Vickers back and forth like a man playing a fire extinguisher against the base of a fire. Then he picked out a few bits of the roadblock that he suspected people might be standing behind and concentrated on them for a while, boring tunnels through the wreckage of the vehicles until he could see what was on the other side, sawing through their frames and breaking them in half. He cut down half a dozen or so roadside trees, behind which he suspected Germans were hiding, and then mowed about half an acre of grass. By this time it had become evident that some Germans had retreated behind a gentle swell in the earth just off to one side of the road and were taking pot shots from there, so Mikulski swung the muzzle of the Vickers up into the air at a steep angle and shot the bullet stream into the sky so that the bullets plunged down like mortar shells on the other side of the rise. It took him a while to get the angle just right, but then he patiently distributed bullets over the entire field, like a man watering his lawn. One of the SAS blokes actually did some calculations on his knee, figuring out how long Mikulski should keep doing this to make sure that bullets were distributed over the ground in question at the right density, say one per square foot. When the territory had been properly sown with lead slugs, Mikulski turned back to the roadblock and made sure that the truck, pulled across the pavement, was in small enough pieces that it could be shoved out of the way by hand. Then he ceased firing at last. Shafto felt like he should make an entry in the logbook, the way ship's captains do when they pull a man of war into port. When they drove past the wreckage, they slowed down for a bit to gawk. The brittle gray iron of the German vehicle's engine blocks had shattered like glass, and you could look into the engines, all neatly cross-sectioned, and see the gleaming pistons and crankshafts exposed to the sun, bleeding oil and coolant. They passed through what was left of the roadblock and drove onwards into a sparsely populated inland area that made excellent strafing territory for the Luftwaffe. The first two fighters that came around were torn apart in midair by Mikulski and his Vickers. The next pair managed to destroy the truck, the big gun, and Private Mikulski in one pass. No one else was hurt. They were all in the ditch, watching as Mikulski sat placidly behind the controls of his weapon, playing chicken with two Messerschmitts and eventually losing. By now it was getting dark. The detachment began to make its way cross-country on foot, carrying Mikulski's remains on a stretcher. They ran into a German patrol and fought it out with them. Two of the SAS men were wounded, and one of these had to be carried the rest of the way. Finally, they reached their rendezvous point, a wheat field where they laid down road flares to outline a landing strip for a U.S. Army DC-3, which executed a deft landing, took them all on board, and flew them to Malta without further incident. And that was where they were introduced to Lieutenant Munkberg for the first time. No sooner had they been debriefed than they were on another submarine bound for parts unknown, or at least unspecified. But when they turned in their warm-weather gear for 10-pound oiled wool sweaters, they started to get an idea. A few claustrophobic days later, they had been transferred onto this freighter. The vessel itself is such a pathetic heap that they have been amusing themselves by substituting the word shit for ship in various nautical expressions. For example, "Let's get this cabin shit-shape. Where in hell does the shit's master think he's taking us?" And so on. Now, in the shit's hold, an impassioned Bobby Shafto is doing his best to create a ransacked effect. He strews rifles and Tommy guns around the deck. He opens boxes of 45 cartridges and flings them all over the place. He finds some skis, too. They'll be needing skis, right? He plants mines here and there just to throw a scare into whatever German happens along to investigate this shit wreck. He opens crates of grenades. These do not look very ransacked, sitting there full, so he pulls out dozens of them, carries them above decks, and throws them overboard. He tosses out some skis also. Maybe they will wash up on shore somewhere and contribute to the overall sense of chaos that is so important to Lieutenant Munkberg. He is on his way across the upper deck, carrying an armload of skis, when something catches his eye out there in the fog. He flinches, of course. Many strafings have turned Bobby Shafto into a big flincher. He flinches so hard that he drops all of those skis on the deck and comes this close to throwing himself down among them. But he holds his ground long enough to focus in on this thing in the fog. It is directly in front of them, and somewhat higher than the bridge of the freighter, and, unlike plunging Zeros or Messerschmitts, it is not moving fast, just hanging there, like a cloud in the sky. As if the fog had coagulated into a dense clump, like his mother's mashed potatoes. It gets brighter and brighter as he stands there watching it, and the edges get more and more sharply defined, and he starts to see other stuff around it. The other stuff is green. Hey, wait a minute. He is looking at a green mountainside with a big white snowfield in the middle of it.
"Heads up!"
he screams, and throws himself down on the deck. He is hoping to be surprised by the gradualness, the gentleness of their collision with the Earth's crust. He has in mind the kind of deal where you run a little motorboat at a sandy beach, cut the motor and tilt it out of the water at the last minute, and glide up gently onto the cushioning sand. This turns out to be a very poor analogy for what happens next. The freighter is actually going a lot faster than your typical putt-putt fishing boat, and instead of gliding up onto a sandy beach, they have a nearly head-on collision with a vertical granite wall. There is a really impressive noise. The prow of the vessel actually bends upwards, and suddenly Bobby Shafto finds that he is sliding on his belly across the ice-glazed deck at a high speed. He is terrified for a moment that he's going to slide right off the deck and go flying into the drink, but he manages to steer himself into an anchor chain, which proves an effective stopper. Down below, he can hear approximately 10,000 other small and large objects finding their own obstacles to slam into. There follows a brief and almost peaceful interlude of near-total silence. Then a hue and cry rises up from the extremely sparse crew of the freighter.
"Abandon ship! Abandon ship!"
The men of Detachment 2702 head for the lifeboats. Shafto knows that they can take care of themselves, so he heads for the bridge, looking for the few oddballs who always find a way to make things interesting. Lieutenants Root and Munkberg, and Corporal Benjamin. The first person he sees is the skipper, slumped in a chair, pouring himself a drink and looking like a guy who just bled to death. This poor son of a bitch is a Navy lifer who got detached from his regular unit solely for the purpose of doing what he just did. It clearly does not sit well with him.
"Nice job, sir,"
Shafto says, not knowing what else to say. Then he follows the sound of an argument into the signals cabin. The dramatis personae are Corporal Benjamin, holding up a large book, in a pose that recalls an exasperated preacher sarcastically acquainting his wayward parishioners with the unfamiliar sight of the Bible, Lieutenant Monkberg, semi-reclined in a chair, his damaged limb up on a table, and Lieutenant Root, doing some needle and thread work on same.
"It is my sworn duty,"
Benjamin begins. Monkberg interrupts him.
"It is your sworn duty, Corporal, to follow my orders."
Root's medical supplies are scattered all over the deck because of the collision. Shafto begins to pick them up and sort them out, keeping an especially sharp eye out for any small bottles that may have gone astray. Benjamin is very excited. Clearly he is not getting through to Monkberg, and so he opens up the hefty book at random and holds it up above his head. It contains line after line, column after column of random letters.
"This," Benjamin says, "is the Allied Merchant Shipping Code. A copy of this book is on every ship of every convoy in the North Atlantic. It is used by those ships to broadcast their positions. Do you understand what is going to happen if this book falls into the hands of the Germans?"
"I have given you my order," Lieutenant Monkberg says.
They go on in this vein for a couple of minutes, as Shafto scours the deck for medical debris. Finally, he sees what he's looking for. It is rolled beneath a storage cabinet and appears to be miraculously unscathed.
"Sergeant Shafto,"
says Root peremptorily. It is the closest he has ever come to sounding like a military officer. Shafto straightens up reflexively.
"Sir, yes, sir."
"Lieutenant Monkberg's dose of morphine may wear off pretty soon. I need you to find my morphine bottle and bring it to me right away."
"Sir, yes, sir."
Shafto is a Marine, which means he's really good at following orders even when his body is telling him not to. Even so, his fingers do not want to release their grip on the little bottle, and Root almost has to pry it loose. Benjamin and Monkberg, locked in their dispute, are oblivious to this little exchange.
"Lieutenant Root,"
Benjamin says, his voice now high and trembly.
"Yes, Corporal," Root says absentmindedly.
"I have reason to believe that Lieutenant Monkberg is a German spy, and that he should be relieved of his command of this mission and placed under arrest."
"You son of a bitch!"
Monkberg shouts. As well he might, since Benjamin has just accused him of treason for which he could face a firing squad. But Root has Monkberg's leg clamped in place up there on the table, and he can't move. Root is completely unruffled. He seems to welcome this unbelievably serious accusation. It is an opportunity to talk about something with more substance than, for example, finding ways to substitute the word shit for ship in nautical expressions.
"I'll see you court-martialed for this, you bastard!"
Monkberg hollers.
"Corporal Benjamin, what grounds do you have for this accusation?" says Enoch Root in a lullaby voice.
"The lieutenant has refused to allow me to destroy the code books, which it is my sworn duty to do,"
Benjamin shouts. He has completely lost his temper.
"I am under very specific and clear orders from Colonel Chatton," Monkberg says, addressing Root.
Shafto is startled by this. Monkberg seems to be recognizing Root's authority in the matter. Or maybe he's scared and looking for an ally. The officers closing ranks against the enlisted men, as usual.
"Do you have a written copy of those orders I could examine?"
Root says.
"I don't think it's appropriate for us to be having this discussion here and now,"
Monkberg says, still pleading and defensive.
"How would you suggest that we handle it?"
Root says, drawing a length of silk through Monkberg's numbed flesh.
"We are ground. The Germans will be here soon. We either leave the code books or we don't. We have to decide now."
Monkberg goes limp and passive in his chair.
"Can you show me written orders?"
Root asks.
"No. They were given verbally,"
Monkberg says.
"And did these orders specifically mention the code books?"
Root asks.
"They did,"
Monkberg says, as if he's a witness in a courtroom.
And did these orders state that the code books were to be allowed to fall into the hands of the Germans?
They did.
There is a silence for a moment as Root ties off a suture and begins another one. Then he says,
A skeptic, such as Corporal Benjamin, might think that this business of the code books is an invention of yours.
If I falsified my own orders, Monkberg says, I could be shot.
Only if you and some witnesses to the event all made their way back to friendly territory and compared notes with Colonel Chatton, says Enoch Root, coolly and patiently.
What the fuck is going on?
Says one of the SAS blokes, bursting in through a hatch down below and charging up the gangway.
We're all waiting in the fucking lifeboats!
He bursts into the room, his face red with cold and anxiety, and looks around wildly.
Fuck off, Shafto says.
The SAS bloke pulls up short.
Okay, Sarge.
Go down and tell the men in the boats to fuck off, too,
Shafto says.
Right away, Sarge,
the SAS man says, and makes himself scarce.
As those anxious men in the lifeboats will attest, Enoch Root continues, the likelihood of you and several witnesses making it back to friendly territory is diminishing by the minute. And the fact that you just happened to suffer a grievous self-inflicted leg wound just a few minutes ago complicates our escape tremendously. Either we will all be captured together, or else you will volunteer to be left behind and captured. Either way, you are saved, assuming that you are a German spy, from the court-martial and the firing squad.
Monkberg can't believe his ears.
But it was an accident, Lieutenant Root. I hit myself in the leg with a fucking axe. You don't think I did that deliberately?
It is very difficult for us to know, Root says regretfully.
Why don't we just destroy the code books? It's the safest thing to do, Benjamin says. I'd just be following a standing order. Nothing wrong with that. No court-martial there.
But that would ruin the mission,
Monkberg says. Root thinks this one over for a moment.
Has anyone ever died, he says, because the enemy stole one of our secret codes and read our messages?
Absolutely,
Shafto says.
Has anyone on our side ever died, Root continues, because the enemy didn't have one of our secret codes?
This is quite a poser. Corporate Benjamin makes his mind up soonest, but even he has to think about it.
Of course not, he says.
Sergeant Shafto, do you have an opinion?
Root asks, fixing Shafto with a sober and serious gaze. Shafto says,
This code business is some tricky shit.
Monkberg's turn.
I believe I could come up with a hypothetical situation in which someone could die, yes.
How about you, Lieutenant Root?
Shafto asks. Root does not say anything for a long time now. He just works with his silk and his needles. It seems like several minutes go by. Perhaps it's not that long. Everyone is nervous about the Germans.
Lieutenant Monkberg asks me to believe that it will prevent Allied soldiers from dying if we turn over the Allied merchant shipping code books to the Germans today,
Root finally says. Everyone jumps nervously at the sound of his voice.
Actually, since we must use a sort of calculus of death in these situations, the real question is, will this somehow save more lives than it would lose?
You lost me there, Padre, says Shafto. I didn't even make it through algebra.
Then let's start with what we know. Turning over the codes will lose lives because it will enable the Germans to figure out where our convoys are and sink them, right?
Right,
Corporal Benjamin says. Root seems to be leaning his way.
That will be true, Root continues, until such time as the Allies change the code systems, which they will probably do as soon as possible. So, on the negative side of the calculus of death, we have some convoy sinkings in the short term. What about the positive side?
Root asks, raising his eyebrows in contemplation, even as he stares down into Monkberg's wound.
How might turning over the codes save some lives? Well, that is an imponderable.
A what?
Shafto says.
Suppose, for example, that there is a secret convoy about to cross over from New York, and it contains thousands of troops and some new weapon that will turn the tide in the war and save thousands of lives. And suppose that it is using a different code system so that even after the Germans get our code books today, they will not know about it. The Germans will focus their energies on seeking the convoys that they do know about, killing perhaps a few hundred crew members. But while their attention is on those convoys, the secret convoy will slip through and deliver its precious cargo and save thousands of lives.
Another long silence. They can hear the rest of Detachment 2702 shouting now, down in the lifeboats, probably having a detailed discussion of their own. If we leave all of the fucking officers behind on the grounded ship, does it qualify as mutiny?
That's just hypothetical, Root says. But it demonstrates that it is at least theoretically possible that there might be a positive side to the calculus of death. And now that I think about it, there might not even be a negative side.
What do you mean?
Benjamin says.
Of course there's a negative side.
You are assuming that the Germans have not already broken that code, Root says, pointing a bloody and accusing finger at Benjamin's big tome of gibberish.
But maybe they have. They've been seeking our convoys left and right, you know. If that's the case, then there is no negative in letting it fall into their hands.
But that contradicts your theory about the secret convoy, Benjamin says.
The secret convoy was just a Gedanken experiment, Root says.
Corporal Benjamin rolls his eyes. Apparently, he actually knows what that means.
If they've already broken it, then why are we going to all of this trouble and risking our lives to give it to them?
Root ponders that one for a while.
I don't know.
Well, what do you think, Lieutenant Root?
Bobby Shafto asks a few excruciatingly silent minutes later.
I think that in spite of my Gedanken experiment, that Corporal Benjamin's explanation, i.e. that Lieutenant Monkberg is a German spy, is more plausible.
Benjamin lets out a sigh of relief. Monkberg stares up into Root's face, paralyzed with horror.
But implausible things happen all the time, Root continues.
Oh, for Pete's sake!
Benjamin shouts, and slams his hand down on the book.
Lieutenant Root,
Shafto says.
Yes, Sergeant Shafto?
Lieutenant Monkberg's injury was an accident. I seen it happen.
Root looks up into Shafto's eyes. He finds this interesting.
Really?
Yes, sir. It was an accident all the way.
Root breaks open a package of sterile gauze and begins to wind it around Monkberg's leg. The blood soaks through immediately, faster than he can wind new layers around it. But gradually, Root starts to get the better of it, and the gauze stays white and clean.
Guess it's time to make a command decision, he says. I say we leave the code books behind, just like Lieutenant Monkberg says.
But if he's a German spy,
Benjamin begins,
then his ass is grass when we get back on friendly soil, Root says.
But you said yourself the chances of that were slim.
I shouldn't have said that, Enoch Root says apologetically. It was not a wise or a thoughtful comment. It did not reflect the true spirit of Detachment 2702. I am convinced that we will prevail in the face of our little problem here. I am convinced that we will make it to Sweden, and that we will bring Lieutenant Monkberg along with us.
That's a spirit, Monkberg says.
If at any point Lieutenant Monkberg shows signs of malingering, or volunteers to be left behind, or in any way behaves so as to increase our risk of capture by the Germans, then we can all safely assume that he is a German spy.
Monkberg seems completely unfazed.
Well, let's get the fuck out of here, then,
he blurts, and gets to his feet, somewhat unsteady from blood loss.
Wait,
Sergeant Shafto says.
What is it now, Shafto?
Monkberg shouts, back in command again.
How are we going to know if he's increasing our risk of capture?
What do you mean, Sergeant Shafto?
Root says.
Maybe it won't be obvious, Shafto says. Maybe there's a German detachment waiting to capture us at a certain location in the woods, and maybe Lieutenant Monkberg is going to lead us directly to the trap.
Attaboy, Sarge,
Corporal Benjamin says.
Lieutenant Monkberg, says Enoch Root. As the closest thing we have to a ship's doctor, I am relieving you of your command on medical grounds.
What medical grounds?
Monkberg shouts, horrified. You are short on blood, and what blood you do have is tainted with morphine, says Lieutenant Enoch Root. So the second-in-command will have to take over for you, and make all decisions as to which direction we will take.
But you're the only other officer, Shafto says, except for the skipper, and he can't be a skipper without a boat.
Sergeant Shafto, Root barks, doing such an effective impersonation of a Marine that Shafto and Benjamin both stiffen to attention.
Sir, yes, sir,
Shafto returns. This is the first and last order I am going to give you, so listen carefully, Root insists.
Sir, yes, sir.
Sergeant Shafto, take me and the rest of this unit to Sweden.
Sir, yes, sir,
Shafto hollers and marches out of the cabin, practically knocking Munkberg aside. The others soon follow, leaving the codebooks behind. After about half an hour of screwing around with lifeboats, Detachment 2702 finds itself on the ground again in Norway. The snow line is about 50 feet above sea level. It is fortunate that Bobby Shafto knows what to do with a pair of skis. The SAS blokes also know this particular drill, and they even know how to rig up a sort of sled arrangement that they can use to pull Lieutenant Munkberg. Within a few hours, they are deep in the woods, headed east, not having seen a single human being, German or Norwegian, since they ran aground. Snow begins to fall, filling in their tracks. Munkberg is behaving himself, not demanding to be left behind, not sending up flares. Shafto begins to think that making it out to Sweden might be one of Detachment 2702's easier missions. The only hard part, as usual, is understanding what the fuck is going on. Diligence. Maps of Southeast Asia are up on the walls and even covering the windows, lending a bunker-like ambience to Avi's hotel room. Epiphyte Corp. has assembled for its first full-on shareholders meeting in 2 months. Avi Hallaby, Randy Waterhouse, Tom Howard, Eberhard Furr, John Cantrell, and Beryl Hagen crowd into the room and pillage the minibar for snacks and soft drinks. Some of them sit on the bed. Eberhard sits barefoot and cross-legged on the floor with his laptop up on a footstool. Avi remains standing. He crosses his arms and leans back, eyes closed, against the endangered mahogany doors of his entertainment center. He is wearing a brilliantly laundered white shirt, so freshly and heavily starched that it still cracks when he moves. Until 15 minutes ago, he was wearing a T-shirt he hadn't taken off his body for 48 hours. Randy thinks for a minute that Avi may have fallen asleep in the unorthodox standing position. But, look at that map, Avi says suddenly in a quiet voice. He opens his eyes and swivels them in their sockets towards Same, not wasting precious energy by turning his head. Singapore, the southern tip of Taiwan, and the northernmost point of Australia form a triangle.
Avi, says Eb solemnly, any 3 points form a triangle.
Generally, they don't look to Eberhard to leaven the proceedings with humor, but a chuckle passes around the room and Avi grins. Not so much because it's funny as because it's evidence of good morale. What's in the middle of the triangle? Everyone looks again. The correct answer is a point in the middle of the Sulu Sea, but it's clear what Avi is getting at.
We are, Randy says.
That's correct, Avi says. Kinakuta is ideally situated to act as an electronic crossroads, the perfect place to put big routers.
You're talking shareholderies, Randy warns.
Avi ignores him. Really, it makes a lot more sense this way.
What way?
Eb asks sharply. I become aware that there are other cable people here. There is a group from Singapore and a consortium from Australia and New Zealand. In other words, we used to be the sole carriers into the crypt. As of later today, I suspect we will be one of three.
Tom Howard grins triumphantly. He works in the crypt. He probably knew before anyone.
Randy and John Cantrell exchange a look. Eb sits up stiffly.
How long have you known about this?
He asks. Randy sees a look of annoyance flash across Beryl's face. She does not like being probed.
Would the rest of you excuse Eb and me for a minute? Randy says, getting to his feet.
Dr. Eberhard Furr looks startled, then gets up and follows Randy out of the room.
Where are we going?
Leave your laptop, Randy says, escorting him out into the hallway. We're just going here.
Why?
It's like this, Randy says, pulling the door closed but not letting it lock. People like Avi and Beryl, who have been in business a lot, have this noticeable preference for two-person conversations, like the one you and I are having right now. Not only that, they rarely write things down.
Explain.
It's kind of an information theory thing. See, if worst comes to worst, and there is some kind of legal action...
Legal action? What are you talking about?
Eb came from a small city near the border with Denmark. His father was a high school mathematics teacher, his mother an English teacher. His appearance would probably make him an outcast in his hometown, but like many of the people who still live there, he believes that things should be done in a plain, open, and logical fashion. I don't mean to alarm you, Randy says. I'm not implying that any such thing is happening or about to, but America being the way it is right now, you'd be amazed how often business ventures lead to lawsuits. When that happens, any and all documents are disclosable. So people like Avi and Beryl never write anything down that they wouldn't want to see in open court. Furthermore, anyone can be asked, under oath, to testify about what happened. That's why two-person conversations like this one are best.
One person's word against another, I understand this.
I know you do.
They should anyway have been discreetly told.
The reason that Avi and Beryl didn't tell us about this until now was that they wanted to work out the problem face-to-face, in two-person conversations. In other words, they did it to protect us, not to hide anything from us. Now they are formally presenting us with the news. Eberhard is no longer suspicious. Now he is irked, which is worse. Like a lot of techies, he can become obstreperous when he decides that others are not being logical. Randy holds up his hands, palms out, in surrender. I stipulate that this does not make sense, Randy says. Eb glares into the distance, not mollified. Will you agree with me that the world is full of irrational people and crazy situations?
Yeah,
Eb says guardedly. If you and I are going to hack and get paid for it, people have to hire us, right? Eb considers it carefully.
Yes.
That means dealing with those people at some level, unpleasant as it may be, and accepting a whole lot of other nonsense, like lawyers and PR people and market troids. And if you or I tried to deal with them, we would go out of our minds, true?
Most likely, yes.
It is good, then, that people like Avi and Beryl have come into existence, because they are our interface. An image from the Cold War comes into Randy's head. He reaches out with both hands and gropes in the air. Like those glove boxes that they use to handle plutonium. See? Eberhard nods. An encouraging sign. But that doesn't mean that it's going to be like programming computers. They can only filter and soften the irrational nature of the world beyond, so Avi and Beryl may still do things that seem a little crazy. Eb has been getting a more and more faraway look in his eyes.
It would be interesting to approach this as a problem in information theory, he announces. How can data flow back and forth between nodes in an internal network?
Randy knows that by this, Eb means people in a small corporation.
But not exist to a person outside.
What do you mean, not exist?
How could a court subpoena a document if, from their reference frame, it had never existed?
Are you talking about encrypting it? Eb looks slightly pained by Randy's simple-mindedness.
We are already doing that. But someone could still prove that a document of a certain size had been sent out at a certain time to a certain mailbox.
Traffic analysis.
Yes, but what if one jams it? Why couldn't I fill my hard drive with random bytes so that individual files would not be discernible? Their very existence would be hidden in the noise, like a striped tiger in tall grass. And we could continually stream random noise back and forth to each other.
That would be expensive. Eberhard waves his hand dismissively. Bandwidth is cheap. That is more an article of faith than a statement of fact, Randy says. But it might be true in the future.
But the rest of our lives will happen in the future, Randy, so we might as well get with the program now.
Well, Randy says, could we continue this discussion later?
Of course.
They go back into the room. Tom, who has spent the most time here, is saying,
The five-footers with yellowish-brown spots on an aqua background are harmless and make great pets. The six-footers with brownish-yellow spots on a turquoise background kill you with a single bite in 10 minutes, unless you commit suicide in the meantime to escape the intolerable pain.
This is all a way of letting Randy and Eb know that the others have not been discussing business while they were out of the room.
Okay, Abby says. The upshot is that the crypt is going to be potentially much bigger than we thought at first, so this is good news. But there is one thing that we have to deal with.
Abby has known Randy forever and knows that Randy won't really be bothered by what is to come. All eyes turn towards Randy, and Beryl picks up the thread. She has arrogated to herself the role of worrying about people's feelings, since the other people in the company are so manifestly unqualified, and she speaks regretfully.
The work Randy's been doing in the Philippines, which is very fine work, is no longer a critical part of this corporation's activities.
I accept that, Randy says. Hey, at least I got my first tan in 10 years.
Everyone seems immediately relieved that Randy is not pissed off. Tom, typically, gets right to brass tacks.
Can we pull out of our relationship with the dentist? Just make a clean break?
The rhythm of the conversation is abruptly lost. It's like a power failure in a discotheque.
Unknown, Abby finally says. We looked at the contracts, but they were written by the dentist's lawyers.
Aren't some of his partners lawyers?
Cantrell asks. Abby shrugs impatiently, as if that's not the half of it.
His partners, his investors, his neighbors, friends, golfing buddies, his plumber is probably a lawyer.
The point being that he is famously litigious, Randy says.
The other potential problem, Beryl says, is that if we did find a way to extract ourselves from the deal with AFCLA, we would then lose the short-term cash flow that we were counting on from the Philippines network. The ramifications of that turn out to be uglier than we had expected.
Damn,
Randy says.
I was afraid of that.
What are the ramifications?
Tom says,
hewing as ever to the bottom line. We would have to raise some more money to cover the shortfall,
Abby says, diluting our stock.
Diluting in how much?
John asks. Below 50%. This magic figure touches off an epidemic of sighing, groaning, and shifting around among the officers of Epiphyte Corp, who collectively hold over 50% of the company's stock. As they work through the ramifications in their heads, they begin to look significantly at Randy. Finally, Randy stands and holds out his hands as if warding them off.
Okay, 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 he says. Where does this take us?
The business plan states over and over that the Philippines network makes sense in and of itself, that it could be spun off into an independent business at any time and still make money. As far as we know, that's still true, right? Abby thinks this over before issuing the carefully engineered statement.
It is as true as it ever was.
This elicits a titter and a bit of sarcastic applause from the others.
Clever, Abby. Where would we be without him?
Okay, Randy says.
So if we stick with the dentist, even though his project is now irrelevant to us, we hopefully make enough money that we don't need to sell any more stock. We can retain control over the company. On the other hand, if we break our relationship with AFCLA, the dentist's partners start to hammer us with lawsuits, which they can do at virtually no cost or risk. We spend a ton of money on lawyers.
And we might even lose, Abby says.
Everyone laughs.
So we have to stay in, Randy concludes. We have to work with the dentist, whether we want to or not.
No one says anything. It's not that they disagree with Randy. On the contrary, it's just that Randy is the guy who's been doing the Philippine stuff and who is going to end up handling this unfortunate situation. Randy's going to take all the force of this blow personally. It is better that he volunteer than that it be forced on him. He is volunteering now, loudly and publicly, putting on a performance. The other actors in the ensemble are Avi, Beryl, Tom, John, and Eb. The audience consists of Epiphyte Corp's minority shareholders, the dentist, and various yet-to-be-impaneled juries. It is a performance that will never come to light unless someone files a lawsuit against them and brings them all to the witness box to recount it under oath. John decides to trowel it on a little thicker.
Afkla's financing the Philippines on spec, right?
Correct, Abby says authoritatively, playing directly to the hypothetical juries of the future. In the old days, cable layers would sell capacity first to raise capital. Afkla's building it with their own capital. When it's finished, they'll own it outright, and they'll sell the capacity to the highest bidder. It's not all Afkla's money. They're not that rich, Beryl says. They've got a big wad from Nogi.
Which is? Ab asks.
Niigata Overseas Holding Group, Inc., three people say in unison. Eb looks baffled.
Nogi laid the deep-sea cable from Taiwan to Luzon, Randy says.
Anyway,
John says,
my point is that since the dentist is wiring the Philippines on spec, he is highly exposed. Anything that delays the completion of that system is going to cause him enormous problems. It behooves us to honor our obligations.
John is saying to the hypothetical jury and dentist V. Epiphyte Corp., we carefully observed the terms of our contract with Afkla. But this is not necessarily going to look so good to the hypothetical jury in the other hypothetical minority shareholder lawsuit, Springboard Group v. Epiphyte Corp. So Avi hastens to add, as I think we've established through a careful discussion of the issues, honoring our obligations to the dentist is part and parcel of our obligation to our own shareholders. These two goals dovetail. Beryl rolls her eyes and heaves a deep sigh of relief.
Let us therefore go forth and wire the Philippines, Randy says.
Avi addresses him in formal tones, as if his hand were resting even now on a Gideon Bible. Randy, do you feel that the resources allotted to you are sufficient for you to meet our contractual obligations to the dentist?
We need to have a meeting about that, Randy says.
Can it wait until after tomorrow? Avi says.
Of course. Why shouldn't it?
I have to use the bathroom, Avi says. This is a signal that Avi and Randy have used many times in the past. Avi gets up and goes into the bathroom. A moment later, Randy says, come to think of it, and follows him in there. He is startled to find that Avi is actually pissing. On the spur of the moment, Randy unzips and starts pissing right along with him. It doesn't occur to him how remarkable this is until he's well into it.
What's up?
Randy asks. I went down to the lobby to change money this morning, Avi says. And guess who came stalking into the hotel, fresh from the airport?
Oh, shit,
Randy says. The dentist himself.
No yacht?
The yacht's following him.
Did he have anyone with him?
No, but he might later.
Why is he here?
He must have heard.
God, he's the last guy I want to run into tomorrow.
Why? Is there a problem?
Nothing I can put my finger on, Randy says.
Nothing dramatic. Nothing that, if it came to light later, would make you look negligent?
I don't think so, Randy says. It's just that this Philippines thing is complicated and we need to talk about it.
Well, for God's sake, Abby says. If you run into the dentist tomorrow, don't say anything about your work. Keep it social.
Got it, Randy says, and zips up.
But what he's really thinking is, why did I waste all those years in academia when I could have been doing great shit like this? Which then reminds him of something.
Oh yeah, got a weird email.
Avi immediately says, from Andy?
How'd you guess?
You said it was weird. Did you really get email from him?
I don't really know who it was from. Probably not Andy. It wasn't weird in that way.
Did you respond to it?
No, but dwarf@siblings.net did.
Who's that? Siblings.net is the system you used to administer, right?
Yeah, I still have some privileges there. I created a new account there, name of Dwarf, which can't be traced to me. Sent anonymous email back to this guy telling him that until he proves otherwise, I'm assuming he's an old enemy of mine.
Or a new one.
Spearhead. The young Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, visiting his grandparents in Dakota, follows a plow across a field. The diving blades of the plow heave the black soil up out of the furrows and pile it into ridges, rough and jumbled when seen up close, but mathematically clean and straight, like the grooves of a phonograph record when viewed from a distance. A tiny surfboard-shaped object projects from the crest of one of those earthen waves. Young Waterhouse bends down and plucks it out. It is an Indian spearhead, neatly chipped out of flint.
U-553 is a black steel spearpoint thrusting into the air about 10 miles north of Tagum. The gray rollers pick it up and slam it down, but other than that, it does not move. It is grounded on a submerged outcropping known to the locals as Caesar's Reef, or Viking's Grief, or the Dutch Hammer. On the prairie, those flint arrowheads can be found lodged in every sort of natural matrix. Soil, sod, the mud of a riverbank, the heartwood of a tree. Waterhouse has a talent for finding them. How can he walk across a field salted by the retreat of the last glacier with countless stones and pick out the arrowheads? Why can the human eye detect a tiny artificial form lost in nature's torn and turbulent cosmos, a needle of data in a haystack of noise? It is a sudden, sparking connection between minds, he supposes. The arrowheads are human things broken loose from humanity, their organic parts perished, their mineral forms enduring, crystals of intention. It is not the form, but the lethal intent that demands the attention of a selfish mind. It worked for young Waterhouse, hunting for arrowheads. It worked for the pilots of the airplanes that hounded U-553 this morning. It works for the listeners of the Beobachtung Dienst, who have trained their ears to hear what is being said by Churchill and FDR on what are supposed to be scrambled telephones. But it doesn't work very well with crypto. That is too bad for everyone except the British and the Americans, who have devised mathematical systems for picking out arrowheads amid pebbles. Caesar's Reef gashed the underside of U-553's bow section open while shoving the entire boat up and partly out of the water. Momentum almost carried her over the hump, but she got hung up in the middle, stranded, a wave-battered teeter-totter. Her bows have mostly filled with water now, and so it is the sharp stern that projects up above the crests of the seas. She has been abandoned by her crew, which means that according to the traditions of maritime law, she is up for grabs. The Royal Navy has called dibs. A screen of destroyers patrols the area, lest some sister U-boat slip in and torpedo the wreck. Waterhouse has been collected from the castle in unseemly haste. Dusk is now falling like a lead curtain, and wolf packs hunt at night. He is on the bridge of a corvette, a tiny escort ship that, in any kind of chop, has the exact hydrodynamics of an empty oil drum. If he stays down below, he'll never stop vomiting. And so he stands above decks, feet braced wide, knees bent, holding onto a rail with both hands, watching the wreck come closer. The number 553 is painted on her conning tower, beneath a cartoon of a polar bear hoisting a beer stein. "Interesting," he says to Colonel Chatton. 553 is the product of two prime numbers, 7 and 79. Chatton manages an appreciative smile, but Waterhouse can tell that it's nothing more than a spectacular display of breeding. The remainder of Detachment 2702 is, meanwhile, finally arriving. Having just finished with the successful Norway ramming mission, they were on their way to their new base of operations on Tagum when they received word of U-553's grounding. They rendezvoused with Waterhouse right here on this boat. Haven't even had a chance to sit down yet, much less unpack. Waterhouse has told them several times how much they are going to like Tagum, and has run out of other things to say. The crew of this corvette lacks ultra-mega clearance, and there is nothing that Waterhouse could conceivably talk about with Chatton and the others that is not classified at the ultra-mega level. So he's trying gamely with prime-number chit-chat. Some of the detachment, the Marine Lieutenant and most of the enlisted men, were dropped off in Tagum so that they could settle into their new quarters. Only Colonel Chatton and a non-com named Sergeant Robert Shafto have accompanied Waterhouse to the U-boat. Shafto has a wiry build, bulging alley-oop forearms and hands, and blonde hair in a buzz cut that makes his big blue eyes look bigger. He has a big nose and a big Adam's apple and big acne scars and some other scars around the orbits of his eyes. The large features in the trim body give him an intense presence. It is hard not to keep looking over in his direction. He seems like a man with powerful emotions, but an even more powerful discipline that keeps them under control. He stares directly and unblinkingly into the eyes of whoever is talking. When no one is talking, he stares at the horizon and thinks. When he is thinking, He twiddles his fingers incessantly. Everyone else is using their fingers to hold on to something, but Shafto is planted on the deck like a fat geezer waiting in line for a movie. He, like Waterhouse, but unlike Chatton, is dressed in heavy foul weather gear that they have borrowed from the stores of this torpedo boat. It is known, and word has gone out to all present, that the U-boat skipper, the last man to abandon ship, had the presence of mind to bring the boat's Enigma machine with him. The RAF planes, still circling overhead, watched the skipper rise to a precarious kneel in his life raft and fling the wheels of the machine in different directions into the steep pitches of hill-sized waves. Then the machine itself went overboard. The Germans know that the machine will never be recovered. What they do not know is that they will never even be looked for, because there is a place called Bletchley Park that already knows all that there is to know about the four-wheel naval Enigma. The Brits will make a show of looking anyway, in case anyone is watching. Waterhouse is not looking for Enigma machines. He is looking for stray arrowheads. The corvette first approaches the U-boat head-on, thinks better of it, and swings far around astern of the wreck, then beats upwind towards it. That way, Waterhouse reckons, the wind will tend to blow them away from the reef. Seen from underneath, the U-boat is actually kind of fat-cheeked. The part that's supposed to be above water, when it's surfaced, is neutral gray, and it's as skinny as a knife. The part that's supposed to be below, when it hasn't just crashed into a great big rock, is wide and black. She has been boarded by adventuresome Royal Navy men, who have cheekily raised a white ensign from her conning tower. They have apparently reached her in a shallow draft whaler that is tied up alongside, loosely bound to her by a sparse web of lines, kept away by bald tires slung over the rail. The corvette, carrying the members of Detachment 2702, edges towards the U-boat cautiously. Each rolling wave nearly slams the boats together.
"We're definitely in a non-Euclidean spatial geometry now," Waterhouse says puckishly.
Chatton bends towards him and cups a hand to his ear.
"Not only that, but it's real-time dependent. Definitely something that has to be tackled in four dimensions, not three. I beg your pardon."
Any closer and they'll be grounded on the reef themselves. The sailors launch an actual rocket that carries a line between the vessels and devote some time to rigging up a ship-to-ship transfer system. Waterhouse is afraid they're going to put him on it. Actually, he's more resentful than afraid because he was under the impression that he wouldn't be put in any more danger for the rest of the war. He tries to kill time looking at the underside of the U-boat and watching the sailors. They formed a sort of bucket brigade to haul books and papers up out of the wreck to the conning tower and from there down into the whaler. The conning tower has a complicated spidery look with gun barrels and periscopes and antennas sticking out all over the place. Waterhouse and Shafto are indeed sent over to U-553 on a sort of trolley contraption that rolls along a stretched cable. The sailors put life jackets on them first, as a sort of hilarious token gesture, so that if they avoid being smashed to bits, they can die of hypothermia instead of drowning. When Waterhouse is halfway across, the trough of a wave passes beneath him, and he looks down into the sucking cavity and sees the top of Caesar's Reef, momentarily exposed, covered with an indigo fur of mussels. You could go down there and stand on it for an instant. Then thousands of tons of really cold water slams into the cavity and rises up and punches him in the ass. He looks up at U-553, entirely too much of which is above him. His basic impression is that it's hollow, more colander than warship. The hull is perforated with rows of oblong slots arranged in swirling patterns like streamlines tattooed onto the metal. It seems impossibly flimsy. Then he peers through the slots. Light is shining all the way through from more slots in the deck, and perceives the silhouette of the pressure hull nested inside, curved and much more solid-looking than the outer hull. She's got two triple-bladed brass propellers, maybe a yard across, dinged here and there from contact with who knows what. Right now, they are thrust up into the air. And looking at them, Waterhouse feels the same absurd embarrassment he felt looking at dead guys in Pearl Harbor whose private parts were showing. Diving planes and rudders stick out of the hull downstream of the propellers, and aft of those, near the apex of the stern, are two crude hatch-like slabs of metal which, Waterhouse realizes, must be where the torpedoes come out. He slides the last 20 feet at terrifying speed and is caught and held in various places by 8 strong hands who lift him to what passes for safety. The deck of the U-boat, just aft of the conning tower, sort of nestled underneath an anti-aircraft gun. Way up at the boat's stern, there's a big T-shaped stanchion with cables coming out of the ends of the crossbar and stretched tight all the way to the conning tower railing, near to hand. Following the example of a Royal Navy officer who appears to be his appointed guardian, Waterhouse climbs uphill, that is, towards the stern, using one of those cables as a sort of banister, and follows him down a hatch in the afterdeck and into the interior of the boat. Shafto follows a few moments later. It is the worst place Waterhouse has ever been. Like the Corvette he has just left, it rises smoothly on each roller, but unlike the Corvette, it comes down with a crash on the rocks, nearly throwing him to the deck. It is like being sealed up in a garbage can that is being beaten with a sledgehammer. U-553 is about half full of a rich brew of cheap wine, diesel fuel, battery acid, and raw sewage. Because of the way she is pitched, this soup quickly gets deeper as you go forward, but it rolls aft in a drenching tsunami every time her midsection slams down on the rocks. Fortunately, Waterhouse is now far beyond nausea, in some kind of transcendent state where his mind has become even more divorced from his body than usual. The officer in charge waits for the noise to subside and then says, in a startlingly quiet voice, "Is there anything in particular you'd like to inspect, sir?" Waterhouse is still trying to get some idea of where he is by shining his flashlight beam around the place, which is kind of like peering through a soda straw. He can't get any synoptic view of his surroundings, just narrow glimpses of pipes and wires. Finally, he tries holding his head still and sort of scribbling the flashlight beam around really fast. A picture emerges. They are in a narrow crawl space, obviously designed by and for engineers, intended to give access to a few thousand linear miles of pipes and wires that have been forced through some kind of bottleneck.
"We are looking for the skipper's papers," Waterhouse says.
The boat goes into free fall again. He leans against something slippery, claps his hands over his ears, closes his eyes and mouth, and exhales through his nose so that none of the soup will force its way into his body. The thing he's leaning against is really hard and cold and round. It's greasy. He shines his light on it. It's made of brass. The light scribbling trick produces the image of a brass spaceship of some sort nestled underneath, unless he's mistaken, a bunk. He's just on the verge of making a total ass of himself by asking what it is when he identifies it as a torpedo. In the next quiet interlude, he asks,
"Is there anything like a private cabin where he might have—"
"It's forward," the officer says. Forward is not an encouraging view.
"Fuck!"
Sergeant Shafto says. It's the first thing he has said in about half an hour. He begins to slosh forward, and the British officer has to hurry to catch up. The deck falls out from beneath their feet again, and they stop and turn around so that the wave of sewage will hit them in the backs. They travel downhill. Every step's a pitched battle versus prudence and sound judgment, and they take a lot of steps. What Waterhouse had pegged as a bottleneck goes on and on, all the way, apparently, to the bow. Eventually, they find something that gives them an excuse to stop. A cabin, or maybe, at about 4 by 6 feet, a corner of a cabin. There's a bed, a little fold-out table, and cabinets made of actual wood. These, in combination with the photographs of family and friends, give it a cozy domestic flavor, which is, however, completely ruined by the framed picture of Adolf Hitler on the wall. Waterhouse finds this to be in shockingly poor taste until he remembers it's a German boat. The mean high tide level of the sewage angles across the cabin and cuts it approximately in half. Papers and other bureaucratic detritus are floating everywhere, written in the occult Gothic script that Waterhouse associates with Rudy.
"Take it all,"
Waterhouse says,
but Shafto and the officer are already sweeping their arms through the brew and bringing them up, wrapped in dripping papier-mâché. They stuff it all into a canvas sack. The skipper's bunk is on the aft or uphill end of the cabin. Shafto strips it, looks under the pillow and under the mattress, finds nothing. The fold-out table is on the totally submerged end. Waterhouse wades into it carefully, trying not to lose his footing. He finds the desk with his feet, reaches down into the murk with his hands, explores as a blind man would. He finds a few drawers which he is able to pull out of the desk entirely and hand off to Shafto, who dumps their contents into the sack. Within a short time, he is pretty sure that there's nothing left in the desk. The boat rises and slams down. As the sewage rolls forward, it exposes, for just a moment, something in the corner of the cabin, something attached to the forward bulkhead. Waterhouse wades over to identify it.
"It's a safe,"
he says. He spins the dial. It's heavy. A good safe. German. Shafto and the British officer look at each other.